number of years ago, I was talking to a brother in Christ, and we were talking about life's treasures. Well, it's not enough.
I suppose I'm on now. It helped turn it on, wouldn't it? I'm sorry, I've never done this before, so bear with me, please. We're talking about life's tragedies and the effects those events in life, whether it be the death of a loved one or the loss of a beloved job or a divorce or whatever it may be, how those events of life wound, how they injure. And he said something that I've never forgotten. He said, those kinds of events can wound us in such a way, they're sort of like a bad leg. It heals, but it doesn't heal all the way. And you can certainly move on and do what you have to do, but his words were, you wind up dragging it with you for the rest of your life. All of us are wounded. All of us have been injured. If you're not, you probably will be before you get out of here. Not this service, but this world. I'm not here to wound you tonight, I don't think. That sounds terrible, doesn't it? The idea of dragging around an emotional wound. Or dealing with something physical that seems to limit us. But if those wounds and those injuries cause us to lean into God, every time we drag that leg, we're reminded that our sufficiency is not in ourselves, but it's of God. So even our injuries, our woundings, our limping can be a strength if we allow it to. Now kind of hang on to that idea. The book of Genesis is a book of beginnings. I think we mentioned this several weeks ago. A book of beginnings. A book of firsts. In Genesis, you read of the first day. You read of the first man. You read of the first sin. You read of the first death. It's a book of beginnings. It's a book of firsts. And it's so pivotal to the overall Bible story. If Genesis isn't true, then the rest of the Bible falls. In the first 11 chapters of Genesis, you have the creation. You have the fall. You have the flood, and you have the Tower of Babel. And those events show the effect of sin entering the world. Beginning in Genesis 12 and going through chapter 50, the book then highlights four major characters through whom God uses to remedy the sin problem that's so glaring in the first 11 chapters. Abraham, to whom he promised to build a great nation in Genesis 12. His son Isaac. His son Jacob, then one of Jacob's sons, Joseph, formed the last half of the book of Genesis. And what you see is how that initial promise given to Abraham, I will bless you, I'll make your name great, I'll make you a great nation, and you, all the families of the earth, shall be blessed. We see that promise unfolding and being reaffirmed first to Isaac, then to Jacob or Israel. Our discussion tonight surrounds Abraham's grandson, Jacob. We first read of Jacob in Genesis chapter 25. Now we're going to look at 32, and we're not going to look at these chapters in detail. If we did, we'd be here 4 or 5 hours, and I know you don't want that. Isaac married a young woman by the name of Rebekah. When he was 40 years old, he began to pray that God would give him offspring. Eventually, Rebekah conceived, and she was pregnant with twins. And God himself explained to her that there were two nations in her womb, warring or struggling against one another. And the Lord said, one shall be stronger than the other, and the older shall serve the younger. It's interesting that when Jacob's sons, or Isaac's sons, were born, Jacob and Esau, Abraham was 160 years old. God had promised him that he would make his descendants number the stars in the sky, the grains of sand on the seashore, and the particles of dust thrown throughout the earth. So here's Abraham at 160 years old, and he's got Isaac, and that's it. How about that dust promise, Lord? It doesn't seem too plausible at this juncture. But Rebekah's going to give birth to twins. Esau would be the older. You can call him Red. That was his name. He came out all hairy and red. You know, can you imagine when he was born? You hold that one, you know. The younger was Jacob. You know what his name literally means, right? Deceiver or supplanter. Remember, the younger or the older would serve the younger. So in that very chapter, once these boys are grown, his brother Esau goes out to hunt. He returns. He's famished. Jacob is a man who dwells in tents. He's a good cook. He's cooking stew. Esau can smell it. He says, give me some of that. I'm dying of hunger. And Jacob, being the manipulator that he was at this time, very deceptive, said, give me your birthright. He took advantage of the situation. And so for a pot of red stew, Esau sold his birthright. As we think of Scripture, though, oftentimes we refer to Jacob stealing his birthright. Well, the reason they say that is because in his deceptive ways, he took advantage of his brother's weakness and took what was so valuable. Now, we need to remember that Esau was complicit in what happened. In fact, the Hebrews writer in Hebrews chapter 12, verses 7 through 11, speaks of what happened when Esau sold his birthright, and he referred to him as a profane person, that is, somebody who takes something very valuable and very special and treats it as if it is nothing. That's Esau. 26, the chapter there in Genesis, things go a little bit different direction. When we get back to chapter 27, we're back to Jacob and Esau. Again, God had chosen that his promise would continue through Jacob. In Malachi chapter 1, verses 2 and 3, we find this cryptic statement by Jehovah where he says, Jacob I have loved, but Esau I have hated. A lot of commentators think about those words and draw a lot of conclusions, but it doesn't mean that God didn't love Esau. It simply means that in his divine arrangement, the promise would go through Jacob, not Esau. He chose Jacob. But as you open to chapter 27 of the book of Genesis, it looks like Esau's going to give the blessing. Pardon me. Isaac is going to give the blessing to Esau. It's hard to keep all of these names straight. Again, he favors Esau. Esau's a man's man. He's an honor. He's Isaac's boy. Whereas Jacob is a man who dwells in tents. He's a mama's boy. That's Rebekah's baby. And so, mother and son, mother, it seems like, as we talked about this morning, decide they'll take the situation into their own hands. They'll deceive Isaac. Jacob will appear as his brother, provide what he wants in the form of a meal, and then he'll receive the blessing. Now, that blessing was promised by God. I don't think any of that deception was needed. Esau was not going to be blessed. But that's what they chose to do, and God allowed them to do it, and they couldn't thwart his plan anyway. But Jacob deceives his own father, and Isaac blesses him. And what we mean by blesses him is that he speaks over him that blessing that had first been given to Abraham and then to him. It's going to flow through him next. He leaves about that time Esau shows up. He's left without any hope. Again, that's what Hebrews 12, verses 7 through 12 is all about, where the Hebrews writer refers to him as a profane person. He wept, but there was nothing that could be done. Well, that enraged Esau. He was extremely angry with his brother. So by the time you get to the end of chapter 27 and you're moving into chapter 28, what do you see happening? Esau plans on murdering his brother. It's interesting. Rebekah feigns this idea. We need to send Jacob away so he can eventually find a bride. It'll just tear me up if he marries one of these Canaanite women. Let's send him to Padan Aram. And so he goes. But of course, her concern was Esau was going to kill him. Looking at the book and kind of walking through it, again, chapter 28, the opening verses, is where we read about Jacob fleeing and going to the home of his relatives to Padan Aram. And there in the middle of chapter 28, beginning in about verse 10, all this is actually important to lead us up to where we're going. You're thinking, my word, do we have to look at everything? Just bear with me here. When Jacob leaves, he's going to camp for the night in a place that he'll later call Bethel. And that's where he sees the ladder that goes up into heaven, and the angels are ascending and descending upon it, and the Lord stands above it, and the Lord speaks to Jacob. And basically what he does is he promises Jacob what he promised Abraham. I'll make your descendants a great nation. They'll number the dust of the earth. And when all the smoke clears, Jacob is amazed. He wakes up and he says, surely God has been in this place, and I didn't know it. And so he called the place Bethel. You know what that means? Bethel, house of God. This place is God's house. And so he made a vow. He vowed that if God would be with him and eventually return him to his home, again, he's fleeing from Esau, he said, I'll serve you. So as we walk through Genesis, as we think about Jacob's life, we come to chapter 29. Eventually he makes it to Padan Aram, and there he's going to meet his uncle Laban, and his uncle Laban is just like him. He's also a deceiver. Jacob falls in love with Rachel, Laban's daughter. He wants to marry her. He agrees to work for her 7 years. Laban agrees to it. And so he gives Rachel to him. But he deceives him, and on the night of their wedding, he gives him Leah instead, the older. He deceives him. The deceiver now has been deceived. Of course, Laban said, well, it's our custom to give the older first. And they sort of worked things out where he would eventually receive Rachel for another 7 years, and he was given her. And for 14 years, he served to pay the dowry for those brides. Then he made an agreement with Laban that he would continue to work for him. Because as long as Jacob was working for Laban, Laban was blessed greatly. But Laban dealt with Jacob treacherously. He changed his wages. He didn't tell him the truth. And so what happens is in the meantime, Jacob marries Leah, Rachel, and he's given their concubines Bilhah and Zilpah. From those four women, those unions, come 12 sons and a daughter. Those 12 sons will make up the heads of the 12 tribes of Israel, which eventually will result in this nation that God promised Abraham that he would build. It's all unfolding, but slowly over time. Jacob becomes wealthier and wealthier. His relatives, Laban's sons, begin to view him with anger and suspicion. God tells Jacob, it's time for you to go back home. What did Jacob vow? You take care of me, you get me back home, I'll serve you. He says, it's time to go back home. So he, with his wives and his children and his flocks and his herds, in secrecy, or at least to the best of their ability, they flee Padan Aram and begin the trek back to Canaan, back to Beersheba. Laban figures out what's happened, and he decides he's going to overtake them because his meal tickets left. Why was he being blessed as he was? Because of Jacob's presence. But now Jacob's left with everything that he's gained while he's there. And so he thinks to himself, I'm going to overtake him. And God appeared to Laban and he said, speak to Jacob neither good nor bad. In other words, don't you lay a hand on Jacob. Finally he overtakes them. There's some interesting interaction, but eventually they make a covenant with one another that they won't do one another any harm. So all of this while, Jacob's been hustling and manipulating and maneuvering and deceiving when necessary to make sure that he has what he needs. And then we come to Genesis chapter 32. He's going to become the patriarch with a limp. You see, by this time, Esau is dwelling in Edom, which is on the outskirts of Canaan. Jacob's on his way home. Messengers come to him. They say, your brother Esau is on his way with 400 of his men. So you know what Jacob is thinking. He's thinking Esau's come to get his revenge. He's going to kill me. What in the world am I going to do? And so he breaks his camp into two companies, hoping that maybe if Esau attacks, one of them will be set free. And several times he would send messengers out to Esau as Esau was coming with presents, great wealth. And so, as Esau draws closer, Jacob decides to send those closest to him over the Jabbok Brook, and he waits there alone. And this is what we see happens as we look at verse 22 of Genesis 32. Genesis 32 and verse 22. And he arose that night and took his two wives and his two female servants and his 11 sons and crossed over the ford Jabbok. He took them, sent them over the brook, and he sent over what he had. Then Jacob was left alone. And a man wrestled with him until the breaking of the day. Now when he saw that he did not prevail against him, that is the man who's wrestling with Jacob, he touched the socket of his hip. And the socket of Jacob's hip was out of joint as he wrestled with him. And he, that is the man wrestling, said, "Let me go, for the day breaks." It speaks to the tenacity of Jacob. Now here's what's interesting. If you look back at verse 9, as Jacob was struggling over the fact that Esau was coming, he prays. He prays. And this is what he prayed, verse 9. "O God of my father Abraham, and God of my father Isaac, the Lord who said to me, 'Return to your country and to your family, and I will deal well with you.' I am not worthy of the least of all the mercies, of all the truth which you have shown your servant, for I've crossed over this Jordan with my staff, and now I have become two companies." What's he saying? Everything I have is because of you. "Deliver me, I pray, from the hand of my brother, from the hand of Esau, for I fear him, lest he come and attack me, and the mother of and the mother with the children, for he said, 'I will surely treat you well and make your descendants as the sand of the sea, which cannot be numbered for multitude.'" What does he do? He said, "Lord, deliver me." And then he says, "Remember your promise." And now, in this historic moment, he finds himself wrestling with this man. Now, we don't know who this man is yet, but Jacob refuses to let go of him. Notice verse 26, the man said, "Let me go, for the day breaks." But he said, "I will not let you go unless you bless me." What blessing do you think he has in mind? How about the one that he prayed about beginning in verse 9? How about the one that God promised that would flow through him when he left home in the first place, that was given initially to Abraham? He says, "Bless me." So he said, "What is your name?" He said, "Jacob." He said, "The man, your name shall no longer be called Jacob, but Israel, for you have struggled with God and with men and have prevailed." Then Jacob asked, saying, "Tell me your name, I pray." And he said, "Why is it that you asked me about my name?" And he blessed him there. So Jacob called the name of the place, "The face of God, Peniel. For I've seen God face to face, and my life is preserved." Just as he crossed over Penuel or Peniel, the sun rose on him, and he limped on his hip. Therefore, to this day, the children of Israel do not eat the muscle that shrank, which is in the hip socket, because he touched the socket of Jacob's hip in the muscle that shrank. Now imagine for a moment. For the rest of Jacob's life, what did he do? He dragged that leg. In one sense, it was from the wounding of struggling with God and men. In other words, it represented all that he had gone through to get to where he was. Every time he would drag his leg, it was a reminder of what? Of the promises of God and how he could trust God to take care of his every need. He didn't have to be a deceiver. He didn't have to be a manipulator. He didn't have to maneuver the circumstances. All he needed to do was to surrender to God's will. God was able to bless him immensely, and as a reminder, he gave him a limp. Well, that brings us to another passage that I want us to look at quickly. That's 2 Corinthians chapter 12. See, we just talked about a patriarch with a limp. Now we're going to talk about a preacher with a problem. And no, I'm not about to testify. Although I've got lots, but so do you. We all have weaknesses, limitations. We all limp. Some of us hide our limping a little better than others. But those things can be used for good if, again, as we said at the beginning, they cause us to lean into God. In 2 Corinthians chapter 12, Paul talks about a man who was caught up into the third heaven. He doesn't want to name himself, but it's evident that's who he has in mind. And then he talks about having a thorn in the flesh, and we've talked about this before, but notice verse 7. Here's what Paul says. What is this thorn? It's in the flesh, and because of that, some say it must have been a physical malady. Who knows? Some say maybe it was a problem with his eyes, his eyesight. You say, why would anybody think that? Because in Galatians 4 and verse 15, as he spoke to those in Galatia, he said, you would have plucked out even your eyes for me. And some think that points in the direction of some sort of problem with the eyes. But the beautiful thing about it is the thorn is not identified. And since it isn't, we can make application of it no matter what's going on in our life. If we're presently struggling or limping or there's some limitation, we can look at how Paul looked at his circumstances, make application, and be better for it. Notice what he says. Verse 7, he says, unless I should be exalted above measure by the abundance of the revelations, a thorn in the flesh was given to me, a messenger of Satan to buffet me, lest I be exalted above measure. In other words, God allowed some sort of negativity in his life so that he would remain submissive to God, depending on God, leaning on God. Verse 8, he says, concerning this thing, I pleaded with the Lord three times that it might depart from me. And the Lord said, my grace is sufficient for you. For my strength is made perfect in weakness. What does he mean, my grace is sufficient for you? He's saying that no matter what you're going through in life, no matter what your wounding is, what your injury is, emotionally, physically, God's grace can uphold you and he can accomplish through you whatever it is that he wants. It doesn't matter. What did Paul say? I'm content in every situation. Why, Paul? How can you be that way? I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. It's not about my strength. It's about God's strength. And usually it's when we're flat on our backs that we remember, hey, I can't do this by myself. But it's in those moments of weakness that oftentimes we're stronger than we ever are, because it's during those moments when the ceiling falls in that, again, we lean into God much more than we do when everything's going well. Right? So here's what Paul says. Therefore, most gladly, I will rather boast in my infirmities, that the power of Christ may rest upon me. Therefore, I take pleasure in infirmities, in reproaches, in needs, in persecutions, in distresses for Christ's sake. For when I am weak, he says, then I am strong. It wasn't until Jacob surrendered and he started limping that he became his strongest. It wasn't until Paul was given a thorn in the flesh and he had to depend on God's strength for all that he could do that he became his strongest. And that's true of any of us. Rather than looking at our injuries and our wounding and our circumstances that are negative as being just that, we need to look at them as opportunities to move that much closer to God. He can work with us and through us no matter what's happening in our lives. We're all people with problems. We're all people with a limp. But every time you drag the leg, remember who can work through you despite it. And let that limping, let that wounding, whatever that injury is, whatever that baggage is, remind you that God is ultimately in control and he can work for you and through you in any situation. Bless me, Jacob said, and God did. But he was wounded in the process. Sometimes that's what we need to draw that much closer to God. The first step in drawing near to God is obeying the truth. Maybe somebody hasn't been baptized into Christ. Your opportunity to come to him in saving faith tonight is yours, and we'll help you to become a Christian if that's what you're looking to do. Or maybe you're struggling. We'd like to pray for you. Remember, God can use you no matter what's going on in your life. If you're dragging your leg, he'll give you the strength to reach the finish line. Let's stand.
Walking Jesus, waiting, waiting.